Have your Bibles this morning, Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9 is where I've opened my Bible this morning. I encourage you to do the same this morning. Luke chapter 9 is where we will read and pretty much dig in. We're going to stick around real close to Luke chapter 9 this morning, so that's where you can follow along in your Bibles. It's kind of funny, when David got up this morning in the previous service and started in Luke chapter 7, you get a little bit nervous when you're the guy who has to go next. That's getting a little bit close to where I'm supposed to be this morning. And it's funny, all the years of working with someone else, it's never happened that each of us planned on preaching on the same text on a Sunday, but this morning scared me a little bit. But that actually is a good, by the way, segue to just remind you, one of the opportunities in our separated services that we're doing this right now is that you actually have the opportunity each week to get another sermon during the week, get some more teaching than just what you've gotten at the building. Our website is set up. We can podcast those sermons. You can get those. Listen to that if you still commute to work, if you're not working at home, if you're back in the office. You can listen to it at some point during the week, maybe on your commute. But it's actually an opportunity to get something that you weren't able to get at the building. And I hope you're taking advantage of that. That is one of the opportunities in this odd and different time that we find ourselves in. Luke chapter 9 is a long chapter in Luke's gospel. It contains a number of stories, some of them quite famous in Jesus' life. One of those stories is the story of the transfiguration, when Jesus takes Peter, James, and John, goes up onto the mountain, and is revealed before their eyes for who and what he really is. He is glorified. There is a cloud that comes down. The glory of God shines. Jesus is transformed, glares in some accounts like the sun, or almost like looking at the sun. Moses and Elijah show up for the party, and that's quite remarkable. And Peter is overwhelmed by the moment. And you know Peter can't help himself, has to say something, no matter how awkward or inappropriate in whatever situation he's in. And so Peter proposes building tabernacles for the three of them, for Moses, for Elijah, and for Jesus. There's a voice from heaven. This is God's son. This is my son. Excuse me. Listen to him. Listen to him. And then it's over, and Jesus looks like he usually does on any given day. And when we pick up in verse 37, on the next day, when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. I want to stop there for just a moment. We're going to read on for just a little bit. But I want to stop right there. On the next day, when they came down from the mountain, because this really is our entry point into what we're going to read and what we're going to think about this morning. This is the entry point. Peter, James, and John have had one of the most magnificent experiences that human men on this earth have ever been privileged to participate in. They have seen Jesus glorified. They've had a taste of the glory to come. They have heard the voice of God. They're in on the ground floor of the new heavens and the new earth. Sometimes in life there are highs, there are great moments. And to be honest, sometimes we want life to be like that all the time. I think that's part of what drives addiction. We don't like or the chase for something new or normal or different, especially in our culture with its frenetic chase for the novel. We don't like the mundane. We want to live in the high places. We want to live in the moments of glory, living with daily life when you have to come down from the mountain. And it's messy, and it's difficult, and it's challenging. And above all things, it's repetitive. It's boring. It sometimes seems like it's the day thing over and over again. Kind of like that old Bill Murray movie. Remember that from about 30 years ago? Oh, it's hard to say. 30 years ago? Groundhog Day. Remember that movie? Great classic Bill Murray movie where the same thing happens over and over. That's a wise movie, by the way. If you have not seen that, go back and watch it till it does make sense. But that's how life works. We live for the mountaintop, but the reality is we have to live off it. We have to live in the daily grind. I mean, this is how life works, right? You live and you anticipate graduation, and it's a great day, and you celebrate, and your family's there, and you get to wear a spiffy robe that you rented from the bookstore, and then it passes, and they give you your sheepskin, and what happens on Monday? You're back on the bottom of the totem pole, new employee orientation. You're getting coffee for somebody who's on the verge of retirement and flaunting it, and now you repay your student loans. Or you buy a new home. Remember the exhilaration? Everyone remembers you. Remember when you bought your first home and the exhilaration of that, and you go through and you get it, and then you find out what home ownership is really about. fixing the AC, that leak that the inspector missed, et cetera, et cetera. I remember when the man and I bought our first home some years ago, and the realtor with us, we were just a couple of young kids. We were 24 and 22 respectively, and the realtor could tell that we were in way over our heads. And I remember he was driving us to a showing, and he tried to talk to us. God bless him. He tried to talk. He said, "Do y'all understand what it means to be homeowners? Do you understand what you're getting into?" "Oh, yes, we understand." And we bought a fixer-upper. And we learned. And it took us 2 months to even make it habitable before we could move in. But that's the reality of life. The highs, we live for the highs. We chase the dream. We're in love with the image. But we have to live in the valleys. We have to live on the ground. Nobody lives on the mountaintop. And even Jesus came down. On the next day when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. This is the reality of daily life with Jesus. It's not all glory and voices from heaven and angels showing up and miracles. It's a hard earthly life in a fallen world. A large crowd met him, and a man from the crowd shouted, saying, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. He's my only boy." And a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams, and it throws him into a convulsion with a foaming at the mouth, and only with difficulty does it leave him, mauling him as it leaves. Kind of like the story David preached to us about in the last hour in Luke chapter 7, a widow with her only son, a desperate parent looking for salvation, for healing, for a reset. A demon that's trying to destroy his son. "I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." And Jesus answered and said, not exactly what you expected to come from Jesus in this moment. And he's not talking to the man. He's talking to his disciples, by the way. Understand when he says this. And boy, how would you like your boss to dress you down like this in public? "You unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." And while he was still approaching, the demon slammed him to the ground, threw him into a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed, just like in Luke 7, at the greatness of God. But while everyone was marveling at all that he was doing, he said to his disciples, "Let these words sink into your ears. For the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men." But they did not understand this statement. It was concealed from them, so they would not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about this statement. You ever been in a meeting like that? Nobody wants to ask the boss what he just meant. You don't want to be that guy, but nobody's getting it. And that's all you're talking about after the meeting. Does anybody get that? Anybody know what we're supposed to do right now? Yeah, that was the disciples. They were afraid to ask, what did he mean? And so an argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. It shows you just how little they understood what he meant. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart, took a child, stood him by his side, and said to them, "Whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For the one who is least among you, this is the one who is greatest." John answered and said, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he does not follow along with us." Now catch that in the context. A man who can do what they could not. And what do the disciples want to do? Shut him down too. They want to hold him back, reduce him to their level. But Jesus said to him, "Do not hinder him, for he was not against you, is for you." Now when the days were approaching for his ascension, he was determined to go to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers on ahead of him. And they went and entered the village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. But they did not receive him, the Samaritans did not, because he was traveling toward Jerusalem. And so when his disciples James and John saw this, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" But he turned and rebuked them, and they went on to another village. All right. So what we have here in this section that we have read from this morning is what seems to be kind of a series of disparate stories. Jesus comes back down from the mountain. The glory of the mountain, the certainty and the clarity of who Jesus is, and the Father speaking from heaven, and Jesus' authority endorsed. And then you come back down, and we focus about it often from the disciples' standpoint on one level, what an experience that must have been for them. But put yourself in Jesus' shoes to get a taste of home for a moment. And then you come back down to this train wreck, where even his disciples don't get it. Even his disciples are continually saying truly ignorant things that show they do not understand, even by this point in the story, who he is, what he's about, what the kingdom's like, what really living before God looks like. How difficult that must have been for Jesus to come back down from the mountain, a taste of home, hearing his Father. And this is what daily life looks like for Jesus. And I just wonder, I wish I could hear the tone in his voice. I wish I could hear how he said to them, "You unbelieving and perverted generation, how long will I have to endure you? How long am I going to have to put up with this?" And so we have this series of stories where he heals a demon-possessed boy. They begin to wrangle about who is the greatest. Jesus, they begin to push back on somebody who can do what they cannot, help people with their problems, cast out the demons that possess them. And Jesus reminds them, no, listen, if he's not working against you, he's on your side. Don't hold him back. You need to become more like him, not the other way around. And then that last story that we looked at there, where the Samaritans reject them, and James and John just want to destroy. They just want to hold back. They want to reduce. And Jesus chastises them for that as well. He rebukes them, and they move on. What do all these stories have in common? Well, on one level, here's what they have in common. This is what daily life with Jesus looks like. This is about what it looks like to journey with Jesus. It's not all mountaintop moments. It's not all about glory and angels. It's not all about all-you-can-eat buffets when loaves and fishes are multiplied. It's not all about spectacular miracles that make you feel warm and fuzzy and safe inside. Because Jesus is here to protect. The truth of the matter is, sometimes the biggest problem Jesus had was not with the unbelievers outside, and it wasn't with the crowds that rejected him, and it wasn't even just with the people who followed along and used him for the free food. It was with his own disciples who publicly embarrassed him, and you know his heart just had to be breaking when he who's come to show the love of God and save the world hears his disciples saying things like, "Stop him, don't let him do that," or, "Hey, let's burn these people up." How alone Jesus must have felt in those moments to realize how alone he truly was when even his 12, even James and John, two of his closest three, show how little they understand who he is and what he's teaching and what he's saying, and above all, in the way he lives, what he's showing them about real life. And what real human life shaped by the love of God and the love of neighbor looks like. This is what it looks like to journey with Jesus. But what does Jesus do? He doesn't turn around and say to James and John, "Well, you want fire from heaven for them. Well, how about some fire from heaven from you? We'll make it work with 10 from now on." That's not what he does. He continues to teach. He continues to exemplify what he wants his disciples to become. But above all, we saw in that text, his face is still set to go to Jerusalem, to offer his life, to save the world from its sins. And in sacrificing his life and shedding his blood, which allows sin to be forgiven once and for all time, in that sacrifice itself, not just the world, but these men, the 12, and within the 12, the three, even James and John, as fiery as they are in this moment, even they will be challenged and changed when they see him not just be merciful to others, but ultimately throw himself into the jaws of death for the sake of people's salvation. And that's when they will finally be changed. Jesus keeps his eye on the goal. He keeps journeying towards Jerusalem, and he takes these poor, deaf, ignorant men with him, that they may be changed by the experience. What I want to do in the few minutes that we have together this morning is I want to look at the stories here. These four stories in particular, but I want to look at these stories that Luke shows, that Luke tells, where you hear Jesus' exasperation, you see him having to rebuke them, you see them failing to do what he has empowered them to do. And I want to look at these four stories and the general ideas that they call up about what it means to journey with Jesus. We look at them, we shake our heads, we feel Jesus' frustration as well, because we, unlike them, are living on the other side of the cross. We've seen the full limits of Jesus' example of where it's headed and what's accomplished in it. We know the end of the story. They don't. Not yet. And so what we can do with these stories is we can look, we can read, we can reflect for just a few moments together this morning, and we can think about what they were, what Jesus was teaching them, what Jesus was offering them, the learning he was offering, that still stands for us. That's why these stories about this journey with Jesus stand here for us. Let me make four quick observations in the time that we have together, and we will be done. Number one, especially in that first episode, when Jesus first comes down from the mountain and they cannot drive out that demon from that boy, and that desperate father comes to Jesus. That's my only son. Jesus, do something for him. Do something for him. Let's talk about that for just a moment. What is that really about? And Jesus is so exasperated with them in that moment. What is it about? It's about them not understanding who's, in one sense, whose power, whose work they're really doing, whose power they're doing it by. They're not able to cast out the demon. But here's the thing that's got to be driving Jesus nuts at this point. Luke chapter 9, but go back to the very beginning of the chapter, verses 1 and 2. Look how that chapter begins. What's already happened in the story? He called the 12 together and he gave them power and authority, what? Over all the demons. And then he sent them out to proclaim the kingdom and to perform healing. And so he's already given them the power, and he's already sent them out to do this. And according to the Gospels, they've already had some success doing this. But something happens in this moment. Something happens in this moment, this time. They can't do it. And Jesus is frustrated not with the man. He's not frustrated with the man who's just trying to save his son. He's frustrated with them, the disciples. And yes, the crowd around, but he's frustrated with the disciples who have been publicly empowered to do this work, have done it in the past, but can't do it in this moment. Why? Well, Luke's gospel just dances around it, just touches it just a little bit when he calls them an unbelieving and perverted generation. But the parallel accounts in Mark and in Matthew help us understand a little bit more about what's going on. In Mark's account, in Mark chapter 9, later on in Mark's account, the disciples come to Jesus privately later in a house, and they ask him point blank, they ask him, why could we not drive it out? Why couldn't we do this, Jesus? Now, Luke's already hinted, you're an unbelieving generation. You guys don't really believe. And we sit there on the one level, we look at that and we say, no, they believe, that's why they follow Jesus. No, they don't believe fully yet. That's why even soon Peter will be arguing with him over whether he should really die in Jerusalem or not. They don't really believe because they won't let Jesus be Jesus and God be God. They're just following along for works of power right now, but they do not understand what they're seeing. They do not understand the meaning of what he is saying. And so when they ask him in the house in Mark's account, why could we not drive it out? Jesus says the most interesting thing to them in verse 29. He says, this kind, that is these demons, cannot come out by anything but prayer. In other words, you really want to be effective in this. The way you get this demon out, you trust in God, you rely upon God in the way that you're not doing right now. You're not truly following me. You're not really listening to me. You're not accurately understanding me. You don't really believe yet. And so you try to do it by your own power. You try to do it in your own understanding. This demon, this kind of demon only comes out with prayer. It only comes out when you really trust in God and rely upon God and turn things over to God, which is exactly what you guys are not ready to do yet. They're not going to want Jesus to die. They're going to contradict him when he says he's going to Jerusalem to die. No, that's never going to happen. In the garden, Peter will be swinging the sword, still trying to stop it. When Peter is challenged with the fact that he's one of Jesus' followers while Jesus is at trial, he'll be reduced to cursing and swearing at a peasant servant girl that he does not know the man, so intimidated and afraid is he. Why is he so afraid? Because he does not really believe yet. These men will be lions for truth in a few weeks on the day of Pentecost, but they're not there yet. They don't truly believe. And their weaknesses and their failures show their lack of faith. Matthew's account touches on this as well. Matthew chapter 17, where Matthew unpacks this. Again, Matthew also records, they ask him privately later, what went wrong? Why could we not drive it out? Verse 19 of Matthew 17. And he said to them, because of the littleness of your faith. In Matthew's account, it's you lack faith. In Mark's account, it's because you don't pray. And in Luke's account, you're a perverted and unbelieving generation. See the line there? Folks, you want to know how much you really believe in God? How's your prayer life going this morning? What does it look like? Do you pray regularly and deeply? Do you pray like your life depends upon it, because it actually does? Why could they not do this? Because they really weren't relying on God's strength. They were trusting more in themselves, their own understanding. That's why they would debate, argue with Jesus. That's why they would challenge him. That's why they would try to protect him from his God-willed destiny in the Garden of Gethsemane. Oh, traveling with Jesus, journeying with Jesus, it's not what you expect. It's a little bit rougher sometimes. And here's Jesus saying, you think you really get me and you really believe in me simply because you follow me. Well, I've seen your prayers, or how little you pray. And I'm here to tell you, you're an unbelieving generation. And so number one this morning, we need to, well, with these stories, remind us when journeying with Jesus, this hodgepodge of stories from the road with Jesus in Luke's gospel. Number one is we need to remember to rely on God's strength more, not ourselves. And when I say rely on God's strength, I'm also talking about relying on God's understanding, what God says is true about reality and how to live, no matter how counterintuitive it seems, no matter how vulnerable it makes us to the world, its wickedness, to unrighteous people. We live God's way. If God says tell the truth, no matter what, guess what? You tell the truth. Even if it seems like it's going to get you in trouble at work, or make a relationship awkward. Anything less, she says, I don't believe really. I follow. I listen when it's convenient, but I don't really believe. Point number two, points to ponder. Number two is this, that serving with God and journeying with God and being part of God's people doesn't mean we don't have problems. It means that we deal with problems. It means that the spiritual struggle in a fallen world is a real battle. In Luke chapter 9, they encounter a really nasty demon. This is not just, you know, some sort of, you know, kind of Halloween spook fest where you just kind of, you know, got a little bit, you know, running through a haunted house or something where actors jump out and try to scare you a little bit. This is a demon who is slamming the child to the ground, throwing him into a convulsion. This is a demon that's trying to destroy an innocent boy. It's real, folks. And listen, just because demon possession doesn't happen like that today doesn't mean that Satan and the demons who worked that way then aren't still just as real today and don't still mean just as much spiritual harm and destruction to the people of God still today. Listen, when Peter says in a verse we all know in 1 Peter 5 and verse 8 that your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Listen, just because demons aren't going to possess your children like this story today does not mean that Satan and his demons don't still roam the world looking for the spiritual destruction of people just like you and me, even right now, today, this hour, Houston, Texas, in September of the year 2020. It is a real battle. It is a true struggle. It's demons that want to destroy innocent children when given the opportunity in a fallen world. That is what we're up against. We love the mountaintop experiences. We love all the glory and the singing and the hallelujahs, but they're not all the time. We have to go down and do the real work of living, and just like Jesus, do the real work of spiritual battle with the forces of evil. We forget sometimes that it's not just about God, it's about the enemy who seeks to destroy us. And the truth of the matter is, folks, the more we come to God, the more the enemy fights back. One of the things that happens in the Bible, take the book of Revelation, for instance, one of the most misunderstood books in the Bible. People get so bogged down on the imagery, they lose sight of the basic message. And one of the basic points that Revelation wants Christians to see, early Christians in particular, but the message is still valid for us today, is that when the world attacks you, when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake, when you experience a setback again because maybe you tell the truth at work, and so you're not in your employer's good graces because you won't say whatever the customer wants to hear just to get the sale. Or maybe it's in a family situation where you have a difficult family member who's not a Christian, and because you speak the truth or hold the line or won't participate in and things you know are wrong, it's caused problems in that family relationship. One of the things that we have to understand is this is Satan's way of oppressing and opposing us, trying to discourage us and tempt us to go back to the world and its ways because it's simpler, it's easier, at least it seems to be. And one of the things the book of Revelation does is it pulls back the veil and says, hey, you know when the world turns against you in this life? What it really is it's the dragon. It's Satan at work through people we know sometimes even, tempting us and driving us to despair and frustration and discouragement. Serving God means dealing with real problems and real opposition. Jesus has to cast out this demon because Satan is at work to destroy the young, the innocent, and the people of God as well. And so we need to recognize what this story reminds us is that serving God means we're going to be challenged in life. Becoming a Christian doesn't necessarily mean life gets easier. Sometimes it flat out is going to mean life is going to get harder because now we are soldiers in the war. And in this time and place, it sure looks like evil is getting ahead and Satan is winning. That's why so many people do give up and go back. That's one of the things that David and I, in talking about the book of Hebrews on Sunday nights right now, are trying to get across. Those Christians had it and were being tempted to go back to what seemed to be a safer place. Because when you choose Jesus, you have to follow him on the very road that he walked, which was through suffering into glory. And so that's number two. That serving God means we're going to have to deal with real problems, real setbacks, real tragedy, real opposition. But number three, one of the other things that happens here is what Jesus does, and we see this in a couple of these stories, is Jesus channels our selfish ambition into ambition for other people's good. He challenges this center of the universe mindset that we are so given to, especially in our time and our place. Here they are, and they can't cast out this demon. And again, now we've got a story of someone else who can, and they want Jesus to stop him. How embarrassing must that have been for them? You ever been in that situation? Maybe you ever had this happen at work? You've been there, you're 25 years into your career, you've been with the company 10 years, and there's this new guy they've hired, and let's be honest, it's awkward because he's better with technology than you are. He knows how to make Excel do things that even though a computer could do. He knows how to make PowerPoint use color. And what you do is you get jealous. And what you do is you feel threatened. And what you do is you watch your back. And rather than empowering or sharing your wisdom, your experience, you watch yourself because you see the handwriting on the wall and you begin to realize, hey, if the boss figures out he could do my job as well as I can or better and he's cheaper, how does this work? Well, then they keep the cheaper younger guy and they get me out. You see this in sports sometimes. That's one thing that's always complimenting. You know, the quarterback is getting older and then the draft, they pick the young hotshot out of college who just won the national championship. And always, well, of course, what is that message to the older quarterback when they drafted another guy in the first round? You're expendable and too expensive. And even Tom Brady has to switch teams eventually, folks. And so what happens? Well, one of two things happens. Either there's awkwardness and problems in the locker room, or what happens is, and coaches often praise this when it happens, the older veteran takes the young guy under his wing and grooms him, recognizing that, hey, listen, in sports, nobody lasts forever, and this guy is the future. I've had my run. But boy, is that a rare thing, isn't it? Boy, is that a rare thing. So here are these disciples, and they see a guy who's better at their job than they are. He can cast out demons. They can't. He's better at being a disciple than they are. But listen, they've got the job title. They're part of the 12. They're the ones who've been officially empowered by Jesus. They carry the official card. They've been licensed professionally, have been to the trainings. They know what they're doing. They're professionals. And here's a guy who can do it better than they can, and they can. So what do they naturally want to do? Shut him down, hold him back, limit him. Why? Because they're the center of the universe. It's about them. It's not about the work of God. It's not about seeing people helped. It's not about seeing demons cast out and Satan pushed back. It's about how embarrassing it must be for them publicly when they have publicly failed. The dad calls in the customer service and goes to their boss above them. He goes to Jesus. Boy, that's awkward. And then the guy over here who's not even on their team does it better than them. Jesus shut him down. But what Jesus does is instead he reminds them, listen, if he's not working against you, he's on your side. He's trying to accomplish the same work that you are. You may not know his name, and we don't even know his name. Jesus pushes back on their implied arrogance. He pushes back on their worrying about who's the greatest. Because isn't that awkward? They can't even do the job right, but they're worried about who's the greatest. And Jesus has to rebuke them, pull the child, and say, listen, become like a child. You guys can't even do your jobs, and you're arguing over who of you gets the number one slot in the 12. How foolish that is. But in the meantime, here's a guy still doing what we fail to do. We want Jesus to stop him because he makes us look bad. And then on top of that, we go on into the Samaritan encounter, and here's a village that doesn't want to receive Jesus, and so they want the village burned up. They're feeling kind of Elijah and Elisha-like today, because after all, that's what Elijah and Elisha used to do, man. They used to call fire down from heaven on people who resisted them. And we're in the same place. We're around Samaria. We're close to where Elijah and Elisha used to work. Pull an Elijah, Jesus, or let us do it. Let's bring down some fire from heaven and destroy them. And what you see in this quick series of stories, who's the greatest, shut the other guy down, let's burn up everybody who opposes us, is that everything they see and everything they encounter is all about them. They learn nothing. They change nothing. Even as Jesus is repeatedly telling them he's going to die, this is what my life's about. You need to change. Let this penetrate deep into your ears, sink into your mind and your heart. You need to see things differently. And instead, it's always about them in some way. Oh, the lessons in these stories about learning dependence, about faith, about the value of humanness and love of others rather than seeking their destruction, about elitism in religion. Doesn't matter whether we can do the job or not, we've got the title and that guy doesn't. All of these are fundamental themes about what it means to walk with Jesus and walk with God, and each of these is taught in this section in some way. Quit being so focused upon yourself and focus on Jesus and focus on his purposes. We have a great God, but we still have great problems and we still have to change. But here's the thing of what Jesus is trying to do. He doesn't want to kill their ambition. He doesn't want to kill their energy. He simply wants to refocus it. He doesn't want them to lose their zeal or their energy. What he wants them to do, though, when he holds up a child and when he tells them about his own coming fate, what he's trying to get them to do is to learn to see and think differently. Have this zeal, but channel it into the correct format and the correct manner. Move it away from self-interest, protecting your own stake, your own turf, your own position before me or in the kingdom or in the eyes of the crowd around here. Quit worrying about you and where you stand and how others see you and channel it into what's good for others. The point is, are people getting rid of the demons that need to be driven out? The point is, are the Samaritans being given an opportunity to have their lives changed, or do we just want to destroy them and pull the trigger too quickly? You're worried about where you sit at the table rather than worrying about why am I at the table in the first place? This is the Lord who teaches by word and by deed that the greatest commands really are love God and love neighbor. And fourthly and finally, very quickly this morning, part of what these stories are reminding us of is at the end of the day, by walking with Jesus, what Jesus really wants is people who learn to look like him, that we are called to be the best reflection of Jesus we can be. Boy, does that fly in the face again of what we're taught in the day and time in which we live. We're told to be the best you that you can be. All the celebrity self-help gurus trying to find your real self, get down to the real you, become your best you. And yet in the Bible, it's the one who loses their life will find it. In the Bible, it's dying to self. That's where life is found. Don't try to be the best you that you can be. Try to be the best imitation of Christ that you can be. Because part of what Jesus was preparing these disciples for is apostleship. They would become the sermon. They would become the vision of Jesus that others would see in what they said and what they did. They would be the people to stand before not just Jews, but even Gentiles, people who had never read the Bible, didn't know about the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And they would have to learn to see God through them and who they are, not just in what they said, but in how they lived. And so the question for us is, how much are we pointing people to the true image of what a human being is supposed to be and do? That was Jesus' frustration. You perverted an unbelieving generation. You still don't get not just who I am. You still don't get who you're supposed to be. You still don't understand what it means to be human. It's not about greatness. It's not about what your employee number is. how high up the seniority chart you are, where you're on in the depth chart, what your title and job rank is, where you're at on the pay scale. Don't try to be the best you that you can be. Be the best imitation of Jesus Christ that you can be. Because at the end of the day, what Jesus is trying to do with them as he challenges them and rebukes them repeatedly and shakes his hand and puts his palm on his forehead, as he's trying to get them to understand what Paul would later write in Philippians chapter 2, words we all know, but sit underneath all of what we're reading and thinking about this morning, that we are called to have this mindset in ourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he himself existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. He did not come down and play the God card every opportunity he had for all the perks and privileges he could get. He didn't show up and take the best parking space because, hey, you know, I'm God and I invented parking. He didn't show up at the meal and say, hey, I get the first and best share because, you know, I made food. When they slept, he would stay up. He'd be the one up all night praying while they slept, praying for them, praying about them. He existed in the form of God, but he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, to be held on to. He let go of the perks and privileges of being deity. He emptied himself, and he took the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. So being found in the appearances of a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And so he lived the perfect human life. And in living the perfect human life, that means he bore the image of God. And of course, he was God truly as well. But both being God and living the human life perfectly would allow him to say things like in John chapter 14, when he was asked, the request was made of him, show us the Father. And he could say, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. And what that trickles down to people like you and I, folks, as we journey with Jesus, not just in the high moments, but in the low moments, the rough moments, the moments when Jesus rebukes us and challenges us and wants to reform our thinking and our way of walking and living, is that we need to get to a point where if people see us and they say, show us Jesus, if they look at our lives, they'll realize they have seen Jesus. Because of what we say and the way we live and the way we walk. And that's the goal, and that's the point. In journeying with Jesus, we learn to journey through life like Jesus. And that's our goal, that's our challenge, that's what we do every day of the week, regardless of what your job title is and where you'll be at Monday morning, or Thursday afternoon, or Saturday, your day off. No matter where you're at, no matter what you're doing, the journey is to into eternity now. Jesus walked to the cross so that we could walk to heaven. And your challenge is to learn to walk the way he walked, so that just as his journey ended with God's pleasure in raising him from the dead, for being faithful unto death, so too when we get to the end of our journey, will our destiny be resurrection, because God is well pleased in us, because we have walked the road like not just like that Jesus walked, but we walked it like he did. So we're going to sing a song here now, and that's your opportunity if you need to start walking with Jesus to come and share that need with us. If you understand who Jesus is and you're ready to obey his gospel, accept his invitation to enter into his kingdom by confessing his name, repenting of your sins, and being baptized for forgiveness of those sins, we're going to encourage you to do that. And if you're here this morning, you're a child of God already, but the journey has been rough and you're not following Jesus well anymore or even at all, and there's something you want to share with the brethren we can pray with you and for you about, we'd be happy to do that as well if you'll talk to us while we stand and while we sing.